This is a Defocus Media production.
Hey guys, welcome back to Four Eyes, the podcast series that gives you a clear view into the optometry world across Canada and the US.
We are your hosts. I'm Dr. Amrit Bilku.
I'm Dr. Deepan Kar.
Hi, I'm Dr. Ravinder Rindawa.
And I'm Dr. Alex Kuhn.
So Nikita, for all of our listeners who may not know who you are or what inclusive psychotherapy is, would you mind telling us a little bit more about yourself and your brand?
Absolutely. So I'm a registered psychotherapist and a registered social worker licensed provincially in Ontario and federally. So I am the founder of Inclusive Psychotherapy, which is a practice where we provide therapy to individuals and couples. Specifically for myself, I specialize in high-functioning depression, high-functioning anxiety, helping my clients navigate dual cultural identities, self-esteem, people-pleasing, perfectionism, and any specific like mental health concerns that are quite specific to the children of immigrants community. That's sort of my niche, but I work mostly with young adults and adults between the ages of 20 to 45.
Mm-hmm. Out of all the types of, you know, therapy that you can provide for people, how did you develop this niche for, you know, children of immigrant parents and high functioning individuals?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. You know, it's interesting because I always struggled to find my niche. When we were in graduate school, we were told that, you know, you have to find a niche, a specific one that really speaks to you. And I always struggled with that until I was looking for a therapist for myself. And I could not find anyone whose bio I read and I went right away, oh, that's the person for me. But that really got me thinking, okay, so there's no millennial brown therapist, female therapist in the community. And if they are, they're not really talking about social justice, or they're not talking about social issues like immigration and children of immigrants and mental health circumstances unique to them. It's one thing to kind of talk about this stuff clinically, and of course that's what I do in my practice as well. I work from a clinical perspective, but more than that, I think I work from a social perspective. So helping my clients unpack their gender identity and how that intersects their mental health, or their cultural identities and how that intersects with their mental health. And I think a lot of the important conversation lies there. So in my search for a therapist, I found my niche.
Yeah. So you can now be your own therapist.
Yeah. Right, yeah. That's gonna end up well.
No, that's really awesome, actually. That's a really underrepresented, you know, category. Even when I think about some of the mental issues that I go through, or even my sister goes through, it's true. Like when you're a child of like immigrant parents, there's like different kind of mental issues and other concerns that you kind of face. And yeah, when I think about it, I'm like, I don't, even when I, like, if I ever was looking for someone to talk to, or like a therapist or someone professional to talk to, that's like one of the questions I would ask is like, will this person really understand where I'm coming from, or why my parents think the way they think, or, but yeah, that's a great niche. So awesome. That's so awesome.
Yeah,
that's exciting. But just getting right into it. So emotions relating to stress, anxiety, and depression can look and feel quite similar. And it can be pretty difficult to pinpoint which emotion is truly being felt. So what are some main differences between these three mental states?
That's a really good question. So anxiety, depression, we kind of all hear these, right, on a day-to-day basis. They've unfortunately become a very common experience for everyone. And I think we're all kind of on a spectrum of anxiety and depression. And there are times in our lives when we're a little bit closer to one end than the other. But these sort of three states, I see them a lot more similar in ways than I do see differences. So there isn't too much variability in these states, because we know that anxiety and depression go hand in hand, and stress is sort of a byproduct, right, of that. But from, I guess, a strictly clinical perspective, depression looks like poor motivation, feelings of guilt, feelings of shame, anhedonia, which is lack of pleasure in anything. So, you know, the things you used to do before no longer bring you happiness. An ongoing sense of emptiness, helplessness. And then obviously the extreme version is like questioning the purpose of life and not wanting to be here anymore. But anxiety can look more like being activated or on all the time. So restlessness, pervasive worry, panic, overthinking, perfectionism. And that's so similar to stress, because I think they both kind of make you feel like you have to be on all the time. Mm-hmm. But like I said, they come hand in hand. So the depression is the low and the anxieties are the highs. Mm-hmm.
I feel like I get a mixture of all of those all the time.
I was like, well,
Is that absolutely. Is that what the high functioning professionals are all feeling? Like a mixture of all three, that they're just too busy to even notice that they're experiencing these symptoms? That's crazy.
Yeah, it could be, you know, I mean, I don't want anyone to listen to this or watch this and feel like they're, oh my gosh, I have anxiety and I have depression. But I think, like I said, we all have so many elements of these that it's not that uncommon to go through, I guess, life or like 25 or 30 or 40 years of life without having felt these states at any given time. They're very common, but it's more about, well, it becomes problematic when it's for a long period of time and there's no changes.
What is a high functioning professional, and do optometrists and optometry students fit into this description?
Yeah, so another good question. So, you know, I was thinking about this one. And so a high functioning professional is basically someone, you know, we can say with high intelligence, high intellect, great problem solving skills, someone detail oriented, very sort of logic based type of thought process and narrative in life. So by that definition, I would say that optometrists and optometry students are quite high functioning, because I think it takes a certain level of intellect and orientation to detail, right? And like a logic based thought process that comes with doing what you guys do. So I think that's absolutely true. Now, a high-functioning stressed-out person or a high-functioning person with high-functioning anxiety or depression, that looks a little bit different, because if you're experiencing high-functioning depression or anxiety, you may be able to function at a higher level in life, in your activities of daily living or your core functions of life than someone else. So not that your anxiety is not as debilitating as it is for someone else, it's just you have become really good at masking it. So you show up to work, you see all your patients, you do whatever you need to do, you go home, you show up for your partner, you show up for everyone else. But at the end of it, like there's nothing left for you to give to yourself. And you just feel like you have to take off all of these masks that you've kind of layered on throughout the day. So you can't be authentic in life, and you don't really feel like you belong, where there's that sense of emptiness that I was talking about earlier. But that high functioning anxiety, you know, for a stressed out professional also can look like, if it's not panic attacks, it can look like people pleasing behaviors or aiming for perfection, need for control, while silently suffering from insomnia, poor appetite, skin picking, right? That's a really common one with the high functioning professionals that I work with, like skin picking around the cuticles or the lips. Hair pulling when you're concentrating. So all of these things are so common, and this is like that package of high functioning anxiety.
Yeah, that sounds, everything that you mentioned sounds really common, not only for myself, but even like people we know, behaviors we've seen, you know, on the exterior, even that sounds pretty common in optometry school, at least. And for some of the, you know, coworkers that we have. So yeah, I agree. We definitely fit into that category of high functioning professional. I'm getting flashbacks of optometry school right now.
Oh gosh. And I imagine too, that was probably a high stress environment, right? For you guys, school, high stress, a lot of emphasis on performance, a lot of competition. So I don't think anyone can come out of that without any sort of scars. But if you really think about it, a lot of us aren't really taught effective stress management. So these things catch up with you really, really fast, especially in high-paced environments like optometry school.
Yeah, Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was just gonna ask if nail biting was a part of those behaviors, because I am a huge nail biter. Like, I don't even notice it sometimes. Yeah. I'll just be like, so it's just like, oh no. But yeah, no.
So that's a good question. So, you know, then my question for you would be, are you biting your nails so excessively that you've kind of hit the nail bed and maybe there's some bleeding or there's
sometimes, yeah. Sometimes. And I don't, and I do it when I'm like uncertain, or if I'm not, you know, when you talk about this people pleasing thing, I'm like, oh, that person's mad at me. Oh God. So I start biting my nails. I don't know if this is like some form of like self mutilation. Like I heard, mm-hmm. I was reading somewhere, like, mm-hmm. you know, if you like bite your nails, or, you know, when you have like the skin hanging off, mm-hmm. the part of the nail, you like kind of rip it off. But yeah, like I was just reading that somewhere. I can't remember what article it was, but I was just like, oh.
No, that's a really good question, right? So that's very common too, the constant nail biting, because I think it's more that you're doing it absentmindedly, right? Mm-hmm. When you're anxious, like you said, you're worried.
Yeah.
You're at it before you even realize it. And it's the same with the nail picking, right?
Yeah.
Someone could mm-hmm. sit there for hours and either pick at their skin on their face or their mm-hmm. nails. And this is so common for my students around exam time.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all sort of a combination of impulse control behaviors and also those fueled by anxiety and worry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it becomes more self-harming when you kind of go into this territory of consciously picking away and inflicting pain upon yourself. Mm-hmm. Right. So if I dig really far down into my cuticle and there's a lot of blood, this is getting really gross.
I know. I was just like, oh God, like it's people are like, gross,
but we've all been there. Like I've purposely picked up my, you know, I'll absentmindedly pick at the skin on my lip, but then at some point I know if I pull it anymore, it's going to bleed and I go for it. So it's like, I just, you know, you just do it. Like it's, I never really thought like deeply about that before. Actually, you know, digging more into what factors or signs you know are contributed to high functioning stress, can you go into any other signs that one can pick out if someone is dealing with high functioning stress? Like, would we be able to identify some of these particular behaviors on somebody else and notice if they're going through any high functioning stress?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess think of when you generally experience stress for yourself, right? How might you be coming across to someone else? So probably your speech is really rapid. Your shoulders might be really tight and hunched, right? You might have like flat affect, so just like a completely stoic face. You might seem really irritable. You might be very sort of snappy. So these are some of the things I think that you can observe in someone. But I think there's signs that someone can also recognize for themselves, right? That they're experiencing a lot of high functioning stress. So obsessive overthinking, worrying about how you're always being perceived. Again, that need for perfectionism, people pleasing, forgetfulness, heart palpitations, mm-hmm. Stomach pain, back pain, loss of sleep, overeating, undereating, poor concentration, headaches, and constantly feeling the need to be like on, like you're running around, you haven't had any caffeine, you're running around the entire day.
Yeah.
And you're kind of just checking off your to-do list from one to the other, to the other, to the other. Mm-hmm. And there's no room for you to just kind of stop and just to be. That is what high functioning stress can look like as well.
I know you talked about this like just a couple minutes before, but again, all these emotions that you're kind of talking about, just like what Amrit said before, all of us have kind of felt these emotions, you know, throughout the day or whatever. But when, if we're feeling it like day to day to day to day, when is it like time to be like, okay, I need to talk to someone or get professional help? Like, when is that limit where you're like, okay, what's happening?
That's a good question. And I personally don't think that, you know, the limit exists. Like, the limit does not exist here, because it's about you accessing support when you think the time is right for you, right? So a lot of people think that therapy is very problem-based and I have to have hit rock bottom or be really right. depressed for me to go therapy. But therapy can be very resource-based. Just like we prioritize gym for our mental health. If you're having some thoughts that you're concerned with, or you're noticing some behaviors that you're saying, you know, this is potentially problematic, go to a therapist, talk them out, talk about where they come from, how they fit into your life. How are they helpful for you? How are they harmful for you? So you may not be entirely, I guess, able to let go of that high functioning anxiety, but I think you can be a lot more intentional in life.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what short-term and long-term consequences can stress and similar emotions have on our bodies, our personal relationships, and overall mental health if we kind of just let it be and not deal with it right away?
That's a good question. And I realized I didn't answer the last one fully with the what factors contribute. Oh. if we're talking about, you know, what contributes to high functioning stress, there's a lot of internal and a lot of external factors. So, I mean, there's so much to this. I don't know if I can do justice to this in like 5 minutes, but we all sort of have this unique story that we tell ourselves about the world and how we fit into the world. And this unique narrative, at the risk of sounding like a cliche therapist, this narrative is really formed in your childhood, right? You develop ideas, core beliefs, a narrative about who you are, what's your purpose, how others around you perceive you, and all of this sort of feeds into that personality development piece, right? So one of sort of the main contributors that we see to high functioning anxiety or stress is family dynamics. So textbook example, but like take a child who's always criticized in the home. She's told that she's not good enough or her grades are not good enough, and that she must try harder. Or she hears other people speak about her in a very, very critical manner. She sees others speak to one another in the home in a very critical manner. Now, this is someone who's more likely to kind of grow up with the narrative that I am not good enough and I constantly need to keep striving for more and more and more and more and more, which is really an attempt to chase that feeling of good enough, right? So this could turn into that need for perfectionism. Or those unhealthy achievement behaviors, like if I just get into that med school, or if I just get that residency, or if I just get that whatever post-grad, you know, then I will be enough and then it will be great. But it's like the feeling that just doesn't exist. It's like an illusion. The more you chase it, the farther it is out of your reach. But this is a really sort of common narrative for high functioning anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. And then you have, you know, the cultural factors. So like someone's cultural identity, right? So we know that achievement and suffering are really the yardstick with which we measure our sense of self-worth, I think, especially a lot in Eastern cultures. So if, again, the story that you're hearing at home is that the only way to be successful is to have that kind of a job or a certain financial stability or this or that, you can constantly start to attach your sense of self-worth with your ability to acquire all of these things.
Yeah.
Right? Which again can lead to more of that sense of perfectionism, people pleasing. And then you have the larger social context of where we live and the social culture. Hustle culture is so glorified for us, right? For our generation, that, oh, you got to have a job and you have to have a side thing and you have to have another side thing.
Yeah.
Right? And constantly hustling is so rewarded. So when it's always been rewarded, you tend to not prioritize self-care. One job just doesn't feel enough. Mm-hmm. And so you're constantly seeking validation in other places. So all sort of these things, you know, they come in together and it's quite convoluted, but they really inform that narrative for someone, which is what drives that high functioning depression and anxiety.
Yeah, I feel like that makes a lot of sense. You know, I think we all come from backgrounds where there's expectations of, you know, what we should be growing up. And like, I know, especially even for Alex, like having a dad who's already an optometrist, mm-hmm. and clearly all the other kids did not become optometrists. And so here's Alex, and you know,
the youngest one, it's like, you're my last chance, Alex.
Yeah. Like that's a lot of pressure too, to always be like, okay, well, my timeline in life has already, half of it's already been kind of determined based on the expectations mm-hmm. of parents, the expectations of siblings, because they're like, well, we ain't gonna do it. So Alex.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it wasn't even my parents though. I think I put it on myself. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it was, and it wasn't because both my parents are so, they never like tried to bring it up or anything, but I like in my head, I felt like that was, you know, the choice.
That was the only choice.
That was
the but I did. I mean, I'm glad I made the choice because I was doing something else. But
anyway,
so I'm happy. But yeah, it was stressful.
You know, when you say people pleasing, I think that is something that I've witnessed a lot, either with myself growing up and with friends, with people around me. A lot of people, I think, are internal. Right? Like there's always that worry that, well, if I don't take this extra step for this one person, you know, what are they going to think of me? And I need to make sure that I can make this connection with this person so that they don't get mad at me. They don't get upset. They don't get angry. And it's really tough to find a place in your life where you can stand up and just be like, you know what? I'm going to do this one thing for me and I'm going to say no to this person, you know, because I don't want to do this extra task or I don't want to deal with this extra thing in my life. So I'm going to say no. And it's really hard for people to learn to do that. You know? Yeah. I don't know. I think people pleasing is something that, can be, I think a lot of people have trouble identifying that they are a people pleaser and how to fix that or how to, you know, kind of change that for themselves.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're all women here. We know that women are socialized naturally to be people pleasers a lot more, right, than men are. And for a lot of women, we measure our sense of self-worth with our ability to do things for other people. So we measure our sense of self-worth with how helpful we are to others. Mm-hmm. And these are those qualities, right, that are taught to us very early on. And this is, I don't mean to say that someone is sitting there, you know, teaching us these things sort of explicitly, but this is the messaging that you absorb when you're out in the world as a young girl. And so it's very easy for that to develop to this sort of toxic people-pleasing where you constantly feel like, if I don't do this, someone's going to be upset with me and that's going to mean something about me.
Okay. So Nikita, what short-term and long-term consequences can stress and similar emotions have on our bodies, personal relationships, and overall mental health if we don't deal with those kind of emotions right away?
We know that now there's a really huge, there's huge body of research and evidence behind the mind-body connection, right? So what happens up here really impacts what's happening here in your entire nervous system. So we know that ongoing chronic stress has shown significant sort of reduction in someone's immunity. So you have higher chances of developing disease because stress gets in the way of your body's ability to produce white blood cells, affects digestion, blood pressure, all of those things. It's actually really interesting. There's a study, I think, out of some Ivy League in the States where they measured undergraduates and their stress levels during the exam season for 3 days. And they noticed that it took almost, I think, 2 months for the white blood cells to come back to normal after just 3 days of exam stress.
Wow. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now imagine if you're constantly living in a state of chronic stress, what that kind of does to your body. But then there's also things like I was saying earlier, headaches, stomach pains, ulcers, tightness in chest, tightness in your shoulders. I mean, how many of us have gone for a massage and the masseuse has told us that we have, like, our shoulders are like brick?
Yep.
Right. And you have more severe cases of any type of chronic illness as well, right? So the more, here's the thing with emotions and mental health, and this is what I tell all my clients, the more you squash it down, the harder it's going to come back. Mm-hmm. And it's going to find ways to come back, right? It's kind of like a dog that you didn't want, but now you have, and you have to feed it, and you have to kind of play with it. You have to give attention to it. Otherwise, it's going to bite your leg off. Mm-hmm. And emotions are exactly the same. The number one thing that I kind of tell my clients is dealing with it right away. It doesn't even look like you need to kind of just get rid of it. It could just look like you becoming more mindful of yourself, right? Becoming more intentional.
Yeah. So it's not yourself. Like a quick fix, right? It's, this is kind of,
I wish,
something that you have to work on and deal with every day. Yeah. So yeah.
I do say that I had a headache basically the first 2 years of optometry school. Like I constantly kept Excedrin in the market by buying it.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you guys remember how much Excedrin I was taking every
day. And Alex would get massages a lot too.
Yeah.
And from the shoulder pain, the back pain, and you know, I'm feeling that now too. I feel like my shoulders are always tensed up. It's like everything that you're saying today, Nikita, is like, I'm just listening to it. And it's like, you just know what's in my soul. Like it's like, you just literally said what my entire life feels like. It's like all these emotions and all these signs and symptoms all at the same time. And to me, it feels normal. Like, and that's the sad part. And that's the hard part to acknowledge, is that all of these symptoms are not normal. They're common, but they shouldn't be symptoms and signs that we are feeling every day. And yeah, so I hope a lot of the listeners that we have today can identify that with themselves too, now that we're actually speaking about these things out loud, kind of, you know, identifying what's going on with them and how they can take that next step to actually deal with it and and treat it.
Yeah, exactly. Even you know, sort of dealing with it, clients will come to me and they'll tell me, well, you know, I don't want to go there because I don't want to open that box, right? Or I'm kind of happy functioning how I'm functioning, even though I know it's not conducive to my health, but I don't want to open this like Pandora's box of emotions. And if anyone listening right now is thinking the exact same thing, I want to propose an alternative, which is that you think you have nicely locked up this Pandora's box with all of like these like nasty feelings and nasty memories inside. And you think you have the key and you think you're out on the outside, but actually you've just locked yourself in with the Pandora's box and you're trapped in it. It's already happening around you anyway. If you don't pay attention to it, it's gonna seep out of the box and into your life, like back pain, chronic pain, stomach ulcers, whatever, right? Or you can choose to open that box and step out and put yourself in a position of power where you can look at all of this that's happening in your life and say, okay, this doesn't serve me anymore. Let's transform it.
What are some tips or practice tools that you recommend for high-functioning professionals to use in order to relieve daily stress?
That's a good question. So I think first it has to start with recognizing and accepting. Right, that okay, there's something happening here that has maybe gotten out of hand or is no longer, like I said, working for you. And be really curious about what is the story that you're telling yourself about how you function in the world, right? So is the story that you're telling yourself that, you know, that six-figure or seven-figure position, that is sort of the way, the key to success and happiness? Or do your values look like something different? Prioritize therapy. Right. Like I said earlier, you don't have to hit rock bottom to feel like you have to go to therapy. Therapy can be resource-based. So find a therapist who has some sort of expertise in this and start a conversation. Any type of movement as well, of course, helps. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and preach that you should be doing cardio 30 minutes a day because I don't do that. I'm not that person. And especially for a high-functioning, stressed-out person, you're probably working a lot more than 8 hours in a day, right? So it's not feasible for you to go to the gym every single day. But that movement can even just look like stretching throughout the day, right? So in between patients, when you have 5 minutes, maybe 2 minutes, close your office door, stretch out your shoulders, stretch out your back, your legs, your arms, because we know that the whenever we're in stress, our brain releases the stress hormones, they go, they find a nice place to sit in our bodies. And until we do anything to intentionally release that cortisol or that adrenaline, it doesn't really go anywhere. So stretching can really help with that. Take 30-second breathing breaks, right? Or every time you go to the bathroom, or again, you have 2 minutes in between patients, close the door, find your breath. Is your breath really shallow? Is it really rapid? Are you feeling connected to where you are, right? All of these tiny, tiny things eventually start to chip away at the anxiety and the stress. It's sort of like drinking your 8 glasses of water. I don't think anyone sits there at 11:30 at night chugging their 8 glasses of water and saying, yep, I got my quota. No, whenever our bodies tell us that we're thirsty throughout the day, we get our glass of water and we drink it.
Yeah.
So we have to listen to our bodies in exactly the same way when it comes to stress and anxiety.
Yeah.
So hopefully that those are quick enough for even the high functioning students and professionals to be able to apply.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. I mean, I've made an active effort to at least stand when my patient leaves, and I finish their chart while I'm standing. So at least I can stretch my legs a little. My back is a little bit straighter. I'll put my arms in the air, just stretch to the ceiling, and then go back down, sit, and finish up my charting. So I know that's definitely helped my shoulder pain a little bit just by standing, so that I don't feel like I'm hunched over when I'm sitting a lot.
That's perfect.
Yeah, like little things every day. But everything that you said is on point with, you know, what I think everyone needs to just fit into their daily lifestyle. Like you said, even if it's 2 minutes, and if you do it every single day at the same time, that'll become part of your routine, right? Just like every other stressful thing that you're doing in your life right now, that's part of your routine. You can try your best to add those little de-stressful moments, you know, into your day. And I think for 2021, that's definitely my goal. My goal was to stretch more. So, you know, I find those quick little 10-minute stretch videos on YouTube. I sit on my carpet and I just stretch for 10 minutes in the morning before breakfast. And I've finally made it a routine for the past month. And it helps. It just makes you feel different throughout the day. It just makes you feel lighter, makes you feel like less worried. You're not thinking about anything, you know, when you're doing this extra activity. So yeah.
Yeah. I think mine for me has just been slowing down my breathing. So I literally do like boxed breathing where I like breathe in for 4 seconds, hold it for 4 seconds, breathe out for 4 seconds and hold that for 4 seconds. And I don't know, I feel like that makes me feel a lot better too. So yeah, just something as simple as my breathing, where I feel like I hold my breath a lot when I'm like stressed or something like that. And then I'm just like, okay, hold on a second. I just become mindful for that 2 minutes. And I just do the boxed breathing, even if there's like a whole bunch of craziness around me. If I have a whole bunch of patients waiting and somewhat like a staff member's like, can you, and I'm just like, all right, like, let me just
hold on.
Breathe. And yeah, I feel, you know, a lot better.
I hope our listeners realize that kind of what Deepon was saying, where, you know, there's so much craziness going on, but you realize that you need a minute to yourself. Mm-hmm. And so again, you said no to somebody who walked up to you and said, hey, listen, I need something right now. You prioritize yourself and you just said, you know what? No, talk to me in 5 minutes. Like, I need this moment to myself. And that's what I really want to challenge all of our listeners to start doing. Like, don't feel bad if you're saying no to somebody when you need a minute to yourself for something.
And people will understand. Like, my staff member was just like, oh yeah, okay, I just, no worries. And you know, it's just like, no one will get mad or anything like that. You know, you just have to just take that moment to yourself. And those moments are really important. And like you said, Nikita, it's not like a quick fix or anything, but you know, it just helps throughout the day, right?
It does.
Yes.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you really think about it, right, not saying no or people pleasing is like advocating for everyone else's needs but your own.
Yeah. Right.
And it's like self-sacrifice, right? So it's about, I think what you're also saying is about intentionally connecting with what you are doing and where that comes from, right? So again, asking yourself, well, what would it mean about me if I said no to this person? And why would that be such a bad thing?
I do have another question relating to one of the earlier questions that we asked, but say if you are recognizing some of these symptoms in a friend or a family member, you know, obviously you can't force anyone to go to therapy or seek professional help, but what can you do as that friend or family member to support that person and let them know, like, hey, I'm here for you. Like, if you need me, I'm here. But you don't want to come off like forceful or anything, or pushy. Yeah. And you know, you don't want to start an argument or something, but you're just like, I just want to let you know I'm here, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a really good question. And you're right. There, it has to be done very gracefully, so the other person doesn't feel attacked or criticized.
Yeah.
Or ambushed in any way. And so part of it is, you know, recognizing that there's no one perfect way of doing this. It depends on the relationship between you and this other person and what the relationship or vulnerability looks like between the two of you. Right. So sort of a standard way that I like to tell my clients about is sort of opening up a conversation and saying, you know, hey, I have something on my mind that I've been wanting to speak to you about for quite some time. Is now a good time? Right. Mm-hmm. So you're not assuming that they're always ready to listen to you. So that creates that culture of understanding and appreciation right off the bat in the conversation. And like you said it actually very well, to be able to come in and say, you know, I'm seeing this behavior and I'm wondering if you noticed this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if this has crossed your mind, or this is what it kind of looks like to me. Is that what's happening for you?
Okay.
And giving that person sort of that opportunity to speak before jumping in, because it's very sort of, it feels very disempowering and helpless to see a loved one experience something, right? Which can, I think, activate like the rescuer complex in us. So you want to step in and you want to rescue this person that you love, when you're also going to have to do a lot of work around sitting with the discomfort of not being able to pull that person out of their troubles and to be able to say, hey, this sucks, but you know, I'm here for you and I'm here to help you unpack it if that's what you want. I'm here to help you find some psychoeducation online if that's something that you need. I can help you maybe set up a free consultation with a therapist, but you let me know whenever you're ready for support and I'll be here for you, and sort of leaving the ball in their court.
Right.
I feel like that's definitely a nicer, more open and inviting way to ask someone if they're okay, rather than just saying, hey, are you okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because then I feel like asking, are you okay, can, like, that's the only way that I know how to ask someone how they're doing, if I'm worried about their behavior, or, you know, if something's changing about them. I kind of realized asking, are you okay, is kind of an easy way out for them to avoid opening up, and they can easily just say, yeah, I'm okay. And then at that point, the conversation has kind of like shut down, right? Like, at that point, you can't ask further questions because technically they're okay.
Yeah.
But I like how you just mentioned, you can, you know, let them know something's been on my mind for a while. You know, do you have time to talk about this? Let me know when you're open to talking about it. I think just the way that you worded it, this is the reason why we wanted a therapist on the podcast, because we've all questioned each other on how to approach this situation and we don't know what's best. And so I think the way you worded it was like much better and just more inviting for someone to finally release whatever has been bothering them and just let it out on the table. You know, for any of our listeners who may strongly relate to this episode with anything that we've discussed, what additional resources would you recommend for them to explore in order to learn more themselves?
So find me. I'm a great resource. of course, follow my socials. I post a lot of tidbits and like a lot of thought-provoking stuff. But really, you know, even just scheduling any type of 15-minute consultations, free consultations with therapists, But something that I think can also be really helpful is the values exercise. And again, you can find my Instagram where I walk you through this values exercise. But for anyone listening right now, there's a very quick way to understand who you are and your narrative in the world. And that's by taking out a piece of paper and a pen and just going ahead and drawing a whole bunch of circles on your paper. And in each circle, writing your values. So money, health, friendship, relationship, whatever. Then taking a second to think about, on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is each value to me, with 10 being most important? And once you're done that, you think about, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much am I living by this value on a day-to-day basis? With 10 being, I'm living by this value all the time. And I think you're gonna learn that maybe your actions aren't in line with your values. Right. So you might really value mental health and physical exercise, but school or your jobs are really taking it all out of you. And this can be a great exercise to help you just recalibrate.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Nikita, for coming on and giving us like just a lot of eye-opening information about ourselves and our profession, because this is obviously not limited to optometry and optometry students, but on our podcast, which is all about optometry, this is definitely a topic that's not spoken about openly, and not spoken about often. So I think hopefully you reached a lot of people today and just made them think a little bit differently about their life, about their actions, about their behaviors, and hopefully encouraged some people to seek therapy, because it is helpful. It's not anything shameful at all. And I think we all just need to encourage more people to try it and see what it's like for them.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much, too, ladies, for having me on here. This was a great conversation.
Thank you to everyone for listening to 4Eyes. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating to give us feedback on how we're doing. You can also check us out on Instagram at 4Eyes Optom for more content. Look out for new episodes every Wednesday. So until then, stay tuned.